wasting my family money all these years. That my mind is focused on the task. That I'm not still having that imaginary conversation with Jordan back in his office where he tells me he found her, and that's why he found me. And then we all go to dinner at the Grant like nothing ever happened. The one where she forgives me and says, God, I missed you, X. And then time melds together like we were never apart. And we fall into old habits. Just the good ones, though. And we laugh again. And it's good. The way it used to be. But of course, if he really did tell me he found her, and he really did tell me that's why he came looking, I'd be back on the road so fast. Because there's only one reason for him to do that. So he could have her again. It's got nothing to do with me, other than I'm the one he needs, not the one he wants. I sigh, close my eyes and shake my head, pulling myself out of the past and refocusing on the present. And then I open them and say, I choose the library. And not because Evangeline Rolaine might like books.
Chapter 3. Evangeline. It's never going to snow again. The thought pops into my head unwanted and takes me by surprise. Ever since I started seeing Lucinda last year, things have been getting progressively better for me. Actually, they got significantly better. After just 6 months of seeing her, I went outside without a hat and sunglasses. I was wearing a sundress. Bare shoulders, bare legs. I went down to the 16th Street Mall and walked through all the crowds without bolting home or hiding in the bathroom until dark. After that, I walked the mall every day for weeks. I went to the library every Sunday and checked out books. I even went to my favorite Chinese restaurant and sat there, alone, and ate an entire meal. Twice. I was normal. Lucinda has been a godsend, and even though I was reluctant after she explained her therapy methods, I gave her a shot, then another, and another, until I was going to see her 3 times a week. She explained her practice to me the first time we met, which included highlighting, anonymously, of course, a lot of former cases involving sexual issues. I don't have a sex problem. Not even a small one, because I don't have sex. Haven't in many years. It's hard to find people to have sex with when you're a recluse. Yes, I've come to terms with that descriptor of myself. Estranged is another word I've learned to embrace. Well, maybe not embrace. I don't want to be estranged from anyone. Not even my asshole parents. I don't want to be a recluse either. It's just, I am those things. What more can I say about it? But Lucinda said she's not a sex therapist. She simply uses sex to conquer fears and psychological disorders. My treatment plan does not involve sex. She made that very clear. I have an unusual phobia. The fear of being watched is pathological in my case, and it's called scopophobia. Lucinda is fairly certain it comes from repressed performance anxiety when I was a child, so I didn't get a hookup as part of my cure. Which is too bad. I could use a hookup, if I'm being honest. Things got better the longer I saw Lucinda. I became braver, bolder, more in control, more assertive, well, a tiny bit more. I mean, I did go outside, and read books, and have small, essential conversations with people like waitresses at the Chinese restaurant. The problem is, I think all that talking, and embracing, and self-reflection, and courage led me to believe I was recovering. Which was a mistake, because I'm not. I'm right back where I started that day I first called her. Afraid, riddled with anxiety, and unable to go outside. My phone buzzes on the couch, but I let it go to voicemail so I can continue looking out the window wishing for snow. Rain. Hell, hurricane-force winds. I'll take anything at this point. I'm dying up here. Dying. I need to get out, but I can't go out until the people go in. Every once in a while I go out at night, but it takes me days to work up to it. And I don't understand. I don't get it. Things were going so well. Weren't they? They were. And then I looked at my bank account and realized I'd spent almost $100,000 on therapy with Lucinda last year. And then I paid my property taxes because I was behind. 2 years. I'm not the most organized person. So that was another $82,000 because the penthouse is now valued at $8 million, not $3. I should sell this place. Move to Mississippi or Louisiana or Texas. Somewhere down south where the real estate is cheap and so are the taxes. I could live like that for a long time. Little shack in a bayou, maybe? Something you'd need a boat to get to. Hidden in all those weirdly twisted cypress trees with Spanish moss hanging off every limb like a curtain. Maybe? Couldn't I? Could totally do that. Should totally do that. A hard knock at my door makes me whirl around, startled. Who the hell got up here? Evangeline! Fuck. I breathe the word out, giving it life as a whisper as my manic episode recedes. More hard knocking. I know you're in there. Open the door. What should I do? Should I run? Jump out the window? Hide in the bathroom? I'm not kidding, Lucinda shouts. I'll stay here all damn day if I have to. Open the door right now and tell me what's going on. I'm sick, I yell at the door. And contagious. A really bad virus. Open the door right now, Evangeline. I'm not going away. I'm moving to the bayou. I'm leaving tomorrow. I hear her laugh, which makes me smile, because I'm being fucking ridiculous, and I know this. I just can't help myself. Okay, Lucinda says. Fine. You're moving to the bayou. Let me in, and I'll help you pack. God, why did I ever call the number on that card? Why? Come on, Lucinda says. Open up, and I promise not to ask you any questions. Cross my heart. I won't, okay? I think about her offer, because I've been up here for weeks now. I'm desperate for someone to talk to, and Lucinda is my only candidate. Evangeline? Fine, I huff. I pull my hoodie over my head, put my sunglasses on, walk to the door, and open it up. What? Lucinda's smug smile at winning this standoff falters as she registers the meaning behind my outfit. Up until I quit seeing her 3 weeks ago, I'd stopped wearing the sunglasses for our visits. She sighs, pushes past me so I can't shut the door in her face, and then goes over to the window and doesn't turn around. You're regressing, she says. I actually have the gall to form the word no, but enough sense not to say it. Because she's right. I'm back where I started last year. I'm worse, in fact. So much worse. It's the show, isn't it? Oh, God. Just hearing the word show makes me want to vomit. I can't do it, I say, breathless from my now rapidly beating heart. I cannot fucking do it. Lucinda turns around but keeps her eyes lowered, not looking at my face. I cannot stand it when people look at me. I fucking hate it. And 3 months ago when I was doing well and I let people look at me and I went outside, I thought I was cured. But then, when I noticed how little money I had left in my bank account, I called my old manager and told him I wanted to do a performance, and what would it take to make a comeback? Cancel it, she says. It's sold out in 10 minutes, I say. It's 2.5 weeks away. So, cancel it. 10,000 people, Lucinda. Cancel it. I can't, I shout. I can't fucking cancel it. I need the money. And the people, God, the people will hate me. Lucinda raises her head and meets my gaze. I fumble with my sunglasses, paranoid that she might get a glimpse of my eyes, then almost have a panic attack when I realize I'm not wearing gloves and she can see my hands. I tuck them into my hoodie pockets and swallow hard, praying I don't have a heart attack, because it feels like I'm going to have a heart attack. Then hoping I do, because if I die, all this anxiety will just go away. I have one last option for you. I laugh as I turn my back to her. She can still see me, but it's better when I can't see her seeing me. I can't be fixed, I say. It doesn't matter what your option is. I cannot be fixed. I'm going to disappoint all those people who bought tickets, and I'm going to go bankrupt and end up living in a shack in the bayou with only a canoe to my name. That's ridiculous, Lucinda says. If you sell this house, You'll make at least $7 million. Just sell the house. I shake my head. No, it's mine. It's all I've got left. If I sell the house, then everything about me has failed. Then do the show, make more money, and go back to being the girl you are underneath all those clothes. It's not that simple. Lucinda grunts. No shit, it's not simple. Do you think I'm an idiot? Do you think I don't know what you're going through? You don't, I say. But I'm whimpering like a sad puppy right now, and that makes everything worse. Then I get angry and turn to her. Do you think I want to be this way? Do you think I want to feel exposed and afraid all the time? Do you think I don't miss playing my violin? Do you think I like living vicariously through the substandard vinyl recordings of other child prodigies? I mean, what the fuck, Lucinda? I'm not doing any of this on purpose. I deflate and sink onto the couch, folding like a woman who's lost everything. Because I have. I had it all at one time. But now it's gone. Even my music. It's gone. Lucinda is quiet as she walks over to the couch, sits down next to me, so close our legs are touching, and takes my hand out of my pocket to stroke it as she talks. I have one last-ditch option for you, Evangeline. If you truly want all those things the way you say you do.
I do, I yell. Why don't you believe me?
Then listen to me. Just take deep breaths and listen to me. I know a man, she says. He deals with special cases for me, and I think you qualify. Not because your phobia is so out of the ordinary, because it isn't. Lots of people have the same fear as you. Not as severely, I admit. But it's very common. What isn't common is needing to conquer it in 2.5 weeks. So, because you need results and you need them quick, I want you to consider this next option. And just hear me out before you say no, okay? I nod. Fine. And do as I'm told. Just sit quietly and listen as she tells me more about her partner, about her plan, about the house and the cameras and the stranger who'll be watching me. She says she's set it all up and I can move in on Friday. And when she's done, she waits. That doesn't even make sense, I say. It's called flooding, Evangeline. It's a tried-and-true technique, a respected technique. Another term for it is exposure therapy, whereby a patient with certain phobic conditions is continuously exposed to their irrational fears over a period of time, forcing them to confront them and make changes. She says all of that in a single breath, like she needs to talk fast, get her idea out into the real world where it can't be dismissed, must be taken seriously, considered. So I don't dismiss her idea. I take it seriously and consider it. Picture what she just said, trying to imagine it and what it might mean. How long will it take? I feel Lucinda shrug. It varies by person, by your commitment to see it through, of course. We can't hold you prisoner. That's illegal. So this has to be 100% consensual. I wave a hand at her. Right, but if I did all that, if I committed to it, then how long?
A few weeks?
I don't have a few weeks. I have 2.5. And if I move into this house on Friday, that's 2 weeks, almost to the day. Can it work in 2 weeks? I hold my breath, waiting for her answer. I don't know, she admits. I can't say, Evangeline. It's really all up to you. I'm not a part of this treatment. You have to take responsibility and see it through. But if you do that, the chances of a quick success are extremely high. Define quick and high, I say, letting myself feel a little whisper of hope building. A week, she says, not very confidently. It's fairly fast because of the in-your-face nature of the treatment. You can't run away. You can't ask for help. You just have to learn to deal. The word weak echoes in my head. I could perform my show, I murmur. Possibly, Lucinda says, if it works. I lower my sunglasses, take them off, and hold them in the hand she's not still stroking, and look at her. Will it work? It's up to you, she says, lowering her gaze so she's not meeting mine. None of your fears are rational, Evangeline. People look at you. People look at everyone. They can't hurt you by looking. She's wrong. They do hurt me. A gaze, a direct stare into my eyes, it's painful for me. Not like a bee sting or stubbing your toe, but like agonizing anxiety that cripples me, makes me irrational. And how can I possibly stand up on stage with my heart beating so fast I make myself pass out from hyperventilating? The cameras will help you. 24 hours a day, someone will be watching you. Who? I ask, too quickly. A chill runs up my spine at the thought, but I can't decide if the tingling is pain or cold or what.
You don't need to know who.
It's anonymous. Who the watcher isn't important. The fact that someone will be watching, and you know they're watching, that's what's important.
My watcher, I say. They'll see me all the time?
Yes, all the time while you're in treatment.
They'll follow me if I leave the house?
Yes, if you're in treatment. If you leave the program, all surveillance will stop immediately.
I swallow hard. So I can opt out at any time?
Of course. I already told you this is all consensual.
I sit there for many minutes, dreaming of the life I might have if this works.
A week? Is it possible I could cure myself in a week? After all this time, after all that money spent, and all those visits to Lucinda, not to mention all the miserable years I've spent up here in this apartment, hiding from the world, now I learn I can cure myself in 7 days? With cameras?
This is real? I ask.
She squeezes my hand. I swear it's real, Evangeline. I think it can help you. You just need to commit to it. Surrender to the plan and see it through. I can't make promises because the outcome all depends on you, not me. Not the watcher, but you. So you have to decide. Can you do this? Lucinda, to her credit, waits as I think it all through. I picture the performance, the applause, playing music again.
I'll need a violin, I whisper, to get ready.
Yes, Lucinda laughs. You will. And you do realize that you are never going to go through with this show, right?
What?
I gasp.
Yes, of course I was. Why would I plan a performance and not follow through?
Because you were looking for a way out, Evangeline, and the performance was your excuse. How do you think you'll play the violin in front of a sold-out crowd in 2.5 weeks if you haven't picked one up in over 10 years?
I think about that for a little bit.
Is she right? Was this all an act of self-sabotage? Was getting better just a trigger to get worse?
I'm a prodigy, I say. I never learned the violin. I just always knew it.
You were a child prodigy, Evangeline. Now you're just another adult who needs to work hard at things. You decided 13 years ago to withdraw from society. You neglected your imagination and stopped expressing yourself. You found solace in the predictable and boring. In hiding away and pretending that attention was painful.
It is, I insist. You have no idea what you're talking about.
Evangeline, I'm a fucking doctor, okay? I have a PhD. I'm board certified in psychoanalysis.
You're a fucking sex therapist.
No, she says, her calm demeanor wavering slightly. I use sex as part of my therapy. There's a big difference. I don't treat people with sex problems. I guide patients, and sex is one tool I use to help them recover. In your case, we will not be using sex as therapy. I told you that a long time ago. We will use a completely anonymous watcher with cameras. That's it.
So forget about the sex.
We sit there quietly for a little bit. I put my sunglasses back on and withdraw my hand from hers.
Friday? I ask.
Yes.
You have this planned?
Yes, it's all been set up for you.
You knew I was failing?
She smiles, takes both my hands in hers to give them a squeeze, and says, I saw it coming from the first time I met you. Moving past hurtful things that trigger a response as debilitating as yours isn't easy, Evangeline. Yes, I always knew you'd fail. But I also knew you had what it takes to get better. I'm treating you because I believe in you. You're not my typical case. You know that.
I know, I say softly. You've done a lot for me, and I appreciate it.
She stands up and looks down at me. I don't want to look her in the face, but I force myself, because she's right. I'm the only one who can cure me now. I am my own last resort. I swallow down the self-loathing all this self-assessment brings up, raise my chin, and square my shoulders. Okay, let's do it.
Chapter 4. Ixion. I sit up straight and stare at the largest of the monitors I've got set up in the basement control room. Someone is at the front gate. A woman. I push away from the panel of screens, jog to the door and yank it open, then sprint across the obscenely large basement to the stairs. I take them three at a time, see my shoes over near the kitchen, slide across the hardwood floors in my socks, grabbing them by the shoelaces as I slip past, and then duck around the corner of one wall, just as the front door opens and the alarm sings in protest. The woman, tall, long, dark hair, wearing a long winter coat and carrying a brown paper grocery bag, pushes all the right numbers of the alarm keypad to make it stop screaming and walks toward the kitchen. This is not Evangeline Rolane. I know that for sure, because this woman is pregnant. Very pregnant. Excuse me, I say, coming out from behind the wall. What the fuck are you doing here? She doesn't jump at my voice or anything stupid like that. Just smiles and sets her bag down on the dark soapstone countertop.
You must be Ixion, she says.
It's just Ix, I say, annoyed. And you are?
Oh, she laughs. Sorry.
She extends her hand for a handshake. I take it as she says,
You don't remember me, do you? I remember you, though. Who could forget that name, right?
She's still smiling, and I still have no fucking clue who she is.
Jordan reminded me, so I cheated, I guess. But our parents were friends. Marcella Walcott. Ring any bells?
I squint my eyes at her. I have no clue.
Well, it's Baldwin now.
She wiggles the fingers on her left hand to flash her diamonds at me. Baldwin? I say.
Smith. You know him, right?
Not really, I say. But your name, I think back.
My father is the senator,
she adds, trying to be helpful. I point at her. Oh, fuck yeah, I know you. She makes a gesture with her hands that says, Of course you do.
Lucinda had an emergency, so she asked me to bring groceries over before her patient checks in tomorrow. So,
she turns back to her grocery bag.
That's what I'm doing.
Got it, I say.
So you and Jordan have been friends all this time?
She looks over her shoulder as she loads vegetables into the fridge. Sorta, I say, fascinated by her. And a little weirded out that two childhood friends have reappeared in my life lately. We go way back, as I'm sure you're aware, but we don't talk much now.
Ah,
she says, closing the fridge with her hip and walking over to the Sub-Zero freezer on the opposite wall.
So he conned you into doing this job, huh?
She laughs a little, like she knows him pretty well and this is just one of those cute things we can count on Jordan doing. Are you and Jordan friends? I ask.
Sorta,
she says, and then she winks at me.
He went to the club a lot when I first met the guys.
Interesting. The club denotes a place called Turning Point. Been around for decades. Jordan wanted to be part of that place in the worst way back in college. But they have an age requirement. And then he went to UCLA for law school. And I was there. And we did... And with... Yeah. Fucking club. Sex is what they do there. So that place is still rolling, huh?
No,
she says.
Brick sold it about a year ago, and I understand that someone is turning it into a hotel.
Ah. I point to her belly. And that's Baldwin's baby?
Of course. She says.
Uh-huh, I say. I have a lot of details I could fill in just based on what she's told me already. None of them come from her, and all of them come from that statement about meeting Jordan at Turning Point Club. I wonder if she fucked him.
Well,
Marcella says, folding up her paper bag and stuffing it in the universal place people stuff folded paper bags. that thin slot of empty space between the fridge and the wall. That's it for me. My job is done. Good luck with yours. Oh, and if you find yourself downtown, I own a tea shop next to where the club used to be. Stop by, and we'll be friends again. She smiles broadly. Or something. I just kind of laugh at that and watch her walk out. Weird. I lock the house back up, rearm the alarm, and go back downstairs to a buzzing phone on the desktop. Yeah, I say. It's caller ID, says it's Jordan. I told you not to be seen, he says. Well, you didn't tell me that some strange chick was going to show up out of the blue. It's none of your business what happens outside your little control room, X. I thought I made that clear. Look, I just didn't know she was coming. A little heads up next time, right? Stay away from this Evangeline girl, Ixion. Why the fuck wouldn't I? I know you, remember? You fuck girls just to see if you can. I actually fucking guffaw. You are no one to judge me. Do not fuck with this girl, Ixion. Understand me? Dude, Evangeline Rolane is the definition of boring. Don't worry. Good, he says. She's so not your type. No shit, she's kind of... Well, I was gonna just say ugly is kind of a default answer, but I've got her picture up on the wall, where I always keep a picture of my targets. And she's not ugly. So I can't even lie about it. She's kind of what? Jordan asks. Uptight, I say. You know, I hate girls like that. Fucking high society bitches with their fancy debutante dresses and fake giggling. Yeah, from the information I've gathered on you up in Wyoming, you like the mean ones, the wasted ones, the easy ones. I shrug. So? Someone's gotta like them. Might as well be me. Stay in the control room. If you see a problem, call me immediately. Do not go upstairs. Hell, do not leave that room under any circumstances unless she leaves the house and you need to follow her. And if that happens, you call me then too. Got it? Got it, I say. You're just like her. Uptight and shit. You got a thing for this girl, Wells? No. He laughs. I just provide a service. Nothing more. Uh-huh. Sure. Well, you don't have to worry about me. I'm not the least bit interested in Evangeline Rolane. And I can't wait for this shit to be over so I can be on my way. Gonna hit up Oregon next. Yeah? Why there? Why not stay here? Why should I stay here? You've got roots here, he says. Not anymore, I say back. That's harsh, he says. I'm just a realist, that's all. Sure, he says. Whatever. I'll call tomorrow afternoon to check in. Stay in that fucking room. I hang up on him. He's told me that like 5 times already. He can fuck off. I have no intention of interacting with the boring ex-child prodigy. But if I did intend to, I would. Because Jordan Wells does not get to make rules for me. Not after he broke them all and ruined my life. In fact, this girl might be good for something after all. I don't need the money, but I could use another game. How about it, Miss Rolane? Would you like to play a game?
Chapter 5. Jordan. I tap Chella's contact on my phone. She picks up immediately. Hello, she sings. She's always in a good mood, like perpetually happy. Even though I love Chella best, sometimes her eternal optimism grates my nerves. I prefer the Rochelles of this world, the Nadias. If Ix likes the mean ones, the wasted ones, and the easy ones, then I like the broken ones, the falling apart ones, the lost and the dark ones. What did he do? I ask her. Nothing really. You know you're a strange guy, Jordan. How so? I ask. Why do you do this shit? Why can't you just settle down? Like Brick, and Smith, and Quinn? And Lucinda, she's out as well, but you keep playing. Don't you get tired of these games? It's not a game, it's a business. Right. Smith has told me all about your new business. So is that what you're doing with Ixion Vanir? Giving him a business experience?
He's just an employee, I say.
Really?
She asks. Really?
So no hard feelings between the two of you?
What's that mean?
I know about you. I looked you up before I went grocery shopping for the house this morning.
So?
So I didn't find anything.
I laugh. What's your point?
On you, at least. But I did find something interesting about Ixion.
He's an interesting guy.
Yes, she says. I think you're right. He is. And he's connected to you, and you're quite interesting in a missing information kind of way.
Anything else, Chella? I'm due in court.
Just one more thing, she says.
What's that?
Who are you trying to fix?
What?
Is it him, or is it you?
I have no... You're so much like Brick. Fuck you, I say, forgetting who I'm talking to for a moment.
But you're different in a lot of ways, too. Brick just played for fun. You take this all very seriously, don't you? It's almost personal, isn't it?
I huff out a breath of air. Goodbye, Chella. Thanks for your help.
No problem, she sings back.
The call ends and I look at the screen as I stare out the window of my corner office in my father's law practice. I'm nothing like Elias Brickman.
Chapter 6. Evangeline. Why can't you at least come with me? I'm whining. I realize this. And even though Lucinda is patient, my neediness is wearing her down. I can almost feel her close her eyes and ask the Lord for patience. And I'm pretty sure she's an atheist, so, yeah. I told you, she explains. You must not associate this house with me. It must become your own. I huff out some air. That's fucking stupid. Well, your phobia is fucking stupid. We both sit on the phone. Silent moments tick off. I think we're holding our collective breath. I think she just closed her eyes again, this time asking the Lord she doesn't believe in to take that back. I'm sorry, she finally says. Whatever, I say. It is stupid. It's not stupid, she counters. Your feelings are legitimate and I'm totally 100% committed to your... Forget it, I say, sort of pissed, but sort of not. I'm mad that you're making me go alone, but I'm certainly grown up enough to not make you feel bad because the truth slipped out. That's mentally mature of you, Evangeline. We both huff out small laughs. So I beg again, just walk me to the gate. No, she says. I'm not going near that house. Ever. When you feel like it's time to leave, you leave. And you call me. And we'll meet. That's how this has to go. I say nothing. She's not going to give in on this. You still there? Yes, I say. I'm picturing everything, that's all. What are you picturing? I'm not sure yet. Well, keep the preconceived notions to a minimum, Evangeline. Just go there with an open mind. It is a man, I ask. My watcher? I'm not going to say. And there's cameras in the bedroom. Of course. Everywhere but the powder room on the main floor. I've already told you that. Is the watcher the guy you work with? No, she says. I will say that. It's not him. That's not professional. Who is that guy? It doesn't matter. Do I know him? No, she says through a sigh. Forget about him. He's just the person who sets things up. That's it. He's not part of my treatment plans. But I'm so intrigued. It's like there's this whole underground world humming along just below my feet, and everyone up top has no clue at all. Like a secret forbidden city hidden away in plain sight. Who is this guy? And how does one get offered the job as Evangeline Rolaine's watcher? I mean, really, how does that happen? How do you find these people? I finally ask. The watchers. This is the only watcher we've had to find, and it's someone we both trust. So you can trust him or her as well. Is it an old woman? I ask. Evangeline. What? I think that's legitimate. I mean, I think old people watching me is creepy. How can I get better if I'm consumed with creepiness? The watcher is not old. How old? She sighs again. 30, 31 maybe? I'm not sure. Right around there. It's a guy, isn't it? Is he hot? If he's hot, that might be kinda hot. This conversation is over now, she sings. Get to the house by noon and settle in. If you decide to stop the treatment, you call me the minute you step out the door. Got it? I sigh, too. Fine. She waits for more, but when I don't give her anything, she says, I think this is gonna work. I hope so, I say back. I really hope so. I've left you a gift in the house. What is it? I ask, unexpectedly excited. I'm not going to tell you, she laughs. It's just a housewarming gift, to make you feel at home. I sigh again. Thank you, Lucinda. I really do appreciate how hard you've worked this past year to help me, and for thinking outside the box as far as this plan goes. It's a risk. We've talked about this. I wouldn't set this up if I didn't think it would help, so I think the chance for total recovery outweighs the risks. I think so, too. I've been thinking about my dress, you know? The one I'll wear for my comeback performance? And I've never done that before. Well, if you need to go shopping for that dress after treatment, I would love to be your second opinion. I smile, picturing Lucinda and I as friends. She's older than me by almost 20 years, but I like her, and she's honest. That comment about my stupid phobia just proves it. Deal, I say. Okay, so you know the rules. 1 week's worth of clothes. If I have to stay longer and I run out, I can do laundry or go shopping. In person, Lucinda stresses. Not online. I swallow hard, but I'm not going shopping. In 1 week, I'll be cured. I'm so sure of it, I force myself not to think about needing to stay longer. Got it. And you have groceries stocked in the fridge for a few days. But if you need anything else... No deliveries, I finish. Right. She pauses, then says, Take chances, Evangeline. That's my best advice. When you think about leaving, pause and tell yourself just one more night. Okay, I say, but this time it's low and soft and barely audible. You're going to do this, Lucinda says. You're going to beat it. I nod my head, then say, I will. I must. I imagine her smiling on the other end of the phone. She thinks I'm brave. She believes in me. Not just my talent, that's easy to believe in once you see me play, but my spirit. Call the number for the car service when you're ready to go, and I'll see you soon. She hangs up. I put my phone down and look at my suitcase. It's packed with normal things. Things I wear around the house. Jeans, yoga pants, sweatshirts, t-shirts. I have my toiletries and my hairdryer. It feels a little bit like the old me, back when I was a kid and we'd travel all over the world. My passport was so full by the time I turned 16 and needed a new one, it was nothing but a mess of indecipherable ink. I don't have a current passport these days. The last one expired a few months ago, and that makes me sad for a few moments, that I was so worldly and sophisticated once upon a time, and now I'm small and lonely. That's why you're doing this, Evangeline. I give myself a pep talk. And if you do it right and stick it out, in 2 weeks you'll be that girl again, only better, because you won't have your parents backstage waiting for their next opportunity. When the driver pulls up outside my building, I roll my 2 suitcases outside, doing my best to blend in with the people, trying not to stand out or be conspicuous in any way. Covered up head to toe with outerwear. Gloves, long winter coat, scarf over my face, large round sunglasses covering my eyes. It's very cold, and snow is falling like glittering dust. But it's not enough to cover me, and my heart starts beating wildly in my chest. The driver must have been told not to make eye contact, because he's wearing sunglasses too, and bows his head as he wordlessly takes my luggage and puts it in the trunk of the long black town car. I get in the back seat without waiting for him to open my door, and quickly shut myself up inside. There's a blackout screen between the front and back, and that, at least, is comforting. There's almost nothing worse than a nosy driver glancing into his rear view, trying to get a glimpse of me. 20 minutes later, after fighting afternoon traffic in downtown, we pass through a small restaurant and shopping district and arrive at a stately manor in what would probably be a very nice tree-lined street in the summertime. There's a tall wrought iron and brick wall surrounding the entire property. It's got something akin to a small guardhouse off to the left, where a driver might interact with security if he were going to pull into the driveway. But my driver stops on the street and doesn't attempt to pull in. There's no one in there anyway. Not anyone to help, because it's only me and my watcher until I decide to leave. I wonder if he or she is spying on the car. The driver gets out, but I wait until he's got my luggage lined up on the sidewalk and he's back in the front seat before I let myself out and close the door behind me. He drives off, leaving me there alone, standing in front of the gate, looking up at the imposing mansion, tiny silver snowflakes falling on my cheeks like slippery wet kisses. I gather myself, eager to get in before any of the neighbors see me, and pull my luggage through the thin layer of snow that's collecting on the ground. There's a code to open the gate, which I use and pass through, and it closes back up automatically when I'm halfway up the front walk. It's an interesting Italianate-style mansion, stucco exterior painted a smooth moss green. There are two ornamental wrought iron balconies in front of the hall, second-story rounded windows, and another directly above the main door. The house is probably almost 100 years old, but everything seems well-kept and modernized on the outside. The grounds are manicured, even in the winter, and the long hedges of holly planted up against the perimeter wall have sharp edges defining their shape that say in no uncertain terms someone loves this place. Even though the house is large and imposing, I am eager to get inside before I can notice anyone noticing me. If I can't see the watchers, they're not there, right? It's how I sell myself on going out at all these days, dark or not, bundled up or not. I need the illusion of being 100% alone, even though I realize it's not possible to control the actions of others, and there could have been 15 people peeking through their front curtains as I got dropped off. As long as I don't see them, I'm fine. Which is why I think this whole camera thing has a chance at working. My one saving grace is the exact thing being exploited here. I key in the code to the front door and the automatic locks disengage. My hand is shaking as I push the front door open, pull my suitcases inside, and close it behind me. I let out a long breath of anxiety-filled air and look around. My heart is thumping in my chest so loud, I swear I can hear it echo off the tall foyer ceiling. In the center of the ceiling is a shimmering chandelier that reflects sunlight coming through the arched window over the door in just the right way so that tiny dewdrop shapes dance across the upper walls like a light show. It's mesmerizing and beautiful. But that's when I see it, a flame-shaped black light bulb in a chandelier filled with white ones. A camera, made to look like a light bulb, with a small blinking red light piercing through the shiny opaque lens. "Hello," I say, surprising myself with my own voice. My brain catches up with the implications of what I just did, and my heart beats erratically at my audacity. Sweat beads on my brow and heat consumes my body as I realize, actually understand for the first time, that someone I don't know will be watching my every move until I say stop. "I can't do this. I cannot." "Breathe," I hear Lucinda's calming voice in my head. But I'm already gasping. I turn, ready to flee back into the safe world I've made for myself, and realize there's no car out there to take me home. Leaving would be worse than staying. Breathe. The powder room. My one sanctuary in this house. The only place where there's no cameras. I open the closest door and find an office. The next is a coat closet. The next is another closet. I rush into the main living area, stunned by how big this place is, by the size of the windows, and the knowledge that some stranger is watching me right now as I lose my shit. This has my head spinning, and the only sound in my ears is the loud thump, 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 thump of my own terrified heartbeat. I whirl around, desperate to find the powder room, because that's my only escape. I'm stuck here until dark, because the thought of going outside in the light and finding help, and that's hours and hours away, and there's no possible way I can stay here and let this watcher watch me, especially now when I'm freaking out. There's a hallway and many, many rooms, but I see the bathroom. I run for it, practically throw myself inside and slam the door shut. I don't even turn on the light. Just press my back against the wall, slide down until I'm sitting on my butt, and wrap my arms around my legs. This was the dumbest idea ever. What the fuck was I thinking? Where the hell do I get off wanting more out of life? When people are starving all over the world and children are homeless on the streets and there's like millions of women who fear for their lives in their own homes. And I'm not talking about my stupid fear, but their very real fear. And people dying and sick and hurting, and I'm just afraid of what amounts to faces pointed in my general direction. This makes me selfish and ungrateful and stupid. So very, very stupid for coming here and wanting more.
Chapter 7. Ixion. Her panic attack, because that's what it is, alarms me. For a few seconds I'm glued to the screen, unable to stop watching. But then, I'm running for the door, an overwhelming urge to reassure overtaken all the rules Jordan gave me. I stop myself just in time. My finger is hovering over the first number on the keypad lock. I'm ready to leave the secret room and go find her. Help her. Breathe. So I do. I inhale deeply, let the swirling, conflicting emotions settle with my racing heart, and think this through as I let it out. She's here for a reason. She hates people looking at her, and that fear has made her life a living hell. Turned her large world into one that's now so small, she barely has room to breathe. I can't relate to it. Honestly, just can't. As a child, my world started small, and only got bigger with each passing day. At first, that's because of the family I was born into. We went everywhere together. But even after I was kicked out of the family with only my trust fund to rely on, I know, poor me. My world expanded. It never shrank. I go everywhere alone now, never staying too long in one place. I get a job, not unlike this one, and I go do it. Then I leave. Or stay. Or leave. The road, I decide, is my home now. The vast, never-ending road that leads to nowhere and everywhere all at once. Now I'm at the point where there's no end to my boundaries. I own things, but aside from that bike over at Jordan's house, they're all things I'm willing to walk away from when my world needs a little more expanding. Like the car back up in Wyoming, for instance. It's a nice car, about 6 years old. But it's not a great car. It's not my dream car. It's just a fucking thing. A replaceable thing. So walking away when I felt the need to cut my losses was just normal for me because the amount of effort it would take to get that car back just wasn't worth it. That would involve a conversation. An explanation, too. Not to mention some self-reflection since I don't actually remember what the fuck happened that night. And fuck that. Not many people in this world get a conversation out of me, let alone an explanation. And I am in no mood to do any sort of self-reflection at the moment. But I can put myself into Evangeline's mindset and wonder how debilitating it would be if I couldn't bear to leave the fucking house. How would it feel if I wasn't able to walk out on people? How would I ever get any peace if I couldn't leave it all behind? Like it or not, she's stuck here now. I cannot imagine she will muster up the courage to walk back out that door and find her way home after this little psycho display. I just can't, because that means her world gets bigger instead of smaller, even if it's just for a few hours. It means she has to go out into it, deal with it, submit to it. I back away from the door, run my fingers through my hair, and then walk over to my chair and sit. Force myself to wait her out. I stalked her a little the past few days, but only online, which is a damn shame. Because I also hunted down all the video I could find on her childhood performances and was mesmerized by her talent. and she's pretty to look at. Not the kind of woman I normally feel attracted to. Too prim, too uptight, too fearful. But she's young, slender, and from what I just saw of her as she entered the house, she might have nice tits. Okay, that's all kind of shallow, but I did think about her talent first, so I'm not going to beat myself up for being a normal 31-year-old man. Especially when I'm never going to get the chance to talk to this woman. Jordan's contract specifically stated that I will not talk to her, ever, even when this is all over. So it's pointless to think about her body, or her face, or her tits, or her fucking talent, for God's sake. She doesn't even play anymore. So I'm not thinking about any of that. I'm just thinking about her mind. And how sad she is. And how lonely she must be. I had a small moment of hope when she entered the house, looked up and found the camera that looked like a black light bulb, and greeted me with a hello. Maybe 3 seconds of hope that this might not be a totally fucked up assignment. That she's more normal than she appears. Or maybe it's all an act. But then her absolute panic over what amounts to a one-sided greeting, nothing even close to a fucking conversation, wiped all that hope away. It's not an act. She's crazy. However, I do relate to her lack of enthusiasm for talking to people. I could care less if I talked to anyone. But it's not fear stopping me. It's just, I'm kind of an asshole and I prefer my own company. That makes me smile. But then I remember she's got herself locked in the bathroom. I fish out my phone and call Jordan, because I'm not sure what to do. Am I her fucking therapy? Does this little display of mental illness qualify as an emergency? Does she need a doctor? Will she try to kill herself? And most importantly, what are my legal obligations in this little job? If she does hurt herself, will I be responsible? Implicated in some sort of crime? I have enough of those on my record. I really don't want to add another over a girl I don't even know. Yeah, Jordan says, picking up the call. Dude, what's the deal with this woman? She's there then? Yeah, she's here. But she kind of freaked out, and now she's locked in the bathroom you told me didn't need cameras. Define freaked out. Full-on fucking panic attack, man. I'm not kidding. She came in, looked around a little, spotted the camera in the foyer chandelier, and then said hello to me. So what's the problem? The problem is she fucking went crazy after that, racing around the house looking for the bathroom, I guess. Now she's locked in there doing what the fuck ever, and I'm just not sure what I'm supposed to do. I'll call you back, Jordan says. And whatever you do, do not leave that room. Got me? Yeah, I say. But he's already ended the call. I sigh and lean back in my chair, wondering if I made a mistake in taking this job. I don't need the money, so why bother? But I know why I bother. People think money is all you need in life. And yeah. It's nice to have money. It's even better to have so much you never have to think about it. Or anything, if you so choose. Which is how I deal with it most of the time. But every once in a while, I'll meet someone, or hear something, and then... Don't fucking go there, Ixion. So I'm lucky, I guess. I have more money than I can ever spend. Sick reality, I get it. Puts me squarely into a subset of the human population called grotesquely rich. But I don't squander it, unless you call walking away from a 6-year-old Jeep Grand Cherokee squandering, which some might. But I'll make up for that. Send that chick the title or something. Let her keep it. Sell it. Whatever. I'm just trying my best to stay unattached and make the most of the life I have. That's just about my only aspiration. Live this fucking life like it's the only one you get. Spend it all because you can't take it with you. And never stop moving. The past might catch up if you stop moving. My motto is faltering today, because against my better judgment, I find this Evangeline woman interesting. What happened to her? Why did she just disappear like that? Did she do something? Someone make her disappear? Was she forced out? Normally I keep this Karen shit to a minimum. It comes at a price, but I can't help myself. It's just intriguing. I want to know the answers to all those questions. Not to mention how she got mixed up with Jordan. It makes no sense at all, because Jordan doesn't gravitate to the kind of women I do, and I have a feeling Evangeline Rolane is more my type than his.
So is Augustine.
My comment surprises me. Where the fuck did that come from? I have not so much as thought her name in 7 years, let alone spoken it out loud.
Why did it have to end that way?
Stop fucking thinking about her. Now!
I know why. My phone buzzes, so I answer it, happy to end the internal struggle I've been avoiding for 7 years.
Yeah.
Okay, I talk to her doctor and she says, leave her alone. She has strict instructions to leave the house if she wants out of the treatment. So if she's still in the house, she's still in treatment.
So if she leaves, I call you?
Yes, Jordan says. If she leaves, call me and let me know what she's doing. Then you follow her, discreetly. If she leaves and calls her doctor, I'll call you, and then the treatment is over and you can just fucking come over here and get your money, I guess. Job's over. Got it? He says, got it. Like this is some super simple shit to process. It's not. So, no, man. I don't got it. Just what the fuck have you gotten me into?
Your job is simple, okay? You watch her. That's it.
And if something bad happens, I'm just supposed to ignore it?
Yes.
What if she tries to kill herself?
She won't.
How the fuck do you know that? She's mentally unstable, Jordan. You can't just let her hurt herself.
I can't-
You're not, he says. She's under the care of a very well-respected psychiatrist. This treatment was planned for a long time. We know what we're doing.
We?
I ask.
We? You're not a fucking doctor.
Correct, Jordan says. I'm just the partner who arranges your treatments.
I open my mouth to say something like,
what kind of fucking game are you playing now?
Or, who the fuck would trust your twisted mind with people who need mental guidance? Because both of those questions are valid. But the call drops. Like, three this convo is over beeps hit me like a goddamn slap in the face. A flash of movement on the monitor makes me look up. Evangeline Rolane has opened the bathroom door.
Chapter 8. Evangeline. The powder room is small and cramped, and the mirror is way too big for my comfort. My image staring back at me is the last thing I need to see. But in the dark, this place is almost perfect. I can't see the mirror, and the walls are close. The heat is on, so it's cozy and warm. The rug is soft. Jesus Christ! What the fuck is wrong with me? I'm extolling the virtues of being locked in a 5x5 room. I am one sick woman. But I'm out of here. I might be sick, but this is sick too. Cameras? Everywhere? Some stranger watching me? What the fuck was I thinking? Thank God I still have my phone on me. I fumble with the phone, trying to press the little icon for contacts, but my hands are shaking so bad I hit just about every app surrounding it. Messages, then photos, then camera. God fucking damn it! I don't even care if my watcher heard that. Finally, my trembling finger hits the right one. The contacts come up. I only have about a dozen, so Lucinda's is in the middle of those. I force myself to hit her name, and not the Chinese restaurant I order takeout from, or my building concierge, and get it on the first try. This small success should not be enough to make me happy, but it does.
Don't tell me you're out already, Lucinda asks.
I don't think I can do this, I say, breathless from the panic attack.
Did something happen?
Her voice is so calm, and normally I love that about her, but right now I just find it irritating. I'm in a strange house filled with cameras. I think everything about that qualifies.
Okay, she says.
But you were ready for this. You made a decision. And you packed your suitcases, and you got into the car and got out of it again. And you went inside. Which was only about 20 minutes ago, Evangeline. So what happened? It's almost imperceptible, but I can hear it in her voice. She's annoyed with me. And for some reason that makes me smile. I'm not playing games with her. I've been pretty straightforward, in fact. No, I haven't told her everything. There are some stories that should never be told. But I've been sincere. Now I don't feel like being sincere, because this whole thing is fucked up. I don't think I can deal with cameras, I say. Can't the Watcher take some of them down? Evangeline, Lucinda says, an even more annoyed Ed.